Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
I'm going to end the broadcast today with a conversation with a young lady who was programmed by a Mormon family, a Mormon mother and father attending a Mormon church. The LDS church was essentially her entire life, or her lifestyle, until she began to have doubts. She began to go against her programming, and then she paid a pretty significant price for it. Her story was brought to my attention several weeks ago and was featured on David Smalley's broadcast, The Dogma Debate, as well as some other atheist websites as we sort of rallied together for her. But she's kind enough to join me at the end of the show to tell her story personally. And I find the story both tragic and also inspiring. But at the beginning, these types of stories are so incredibly frustrating to hear. They're so senseless. And they happen so often. I've been really grieved lately by the targeting of kids and the consequences for young people who don't hold to their parents' belief system, who essentially say, thanks so much, I'm not going to be spoon-fed my future, I would like to figure this stuff out for myself, and so they go and do so, and many of them pay a dramatic price. And it's frustrating, I think, to speak out against the indoctrination of young children on what I think is very reasonable grounds, and to have all these religious people come after me or whoever is challenging them because we're just stealing their joy and sucking the fun out of it. And it's such a beautiful thing. A great example is this video that's been flying around Facebook, posted in this case by WAFJ. I think it's a radio station. 88.3. There it is. 88.3 WAFJ, posted August 28th. And the description says, teach them to pray. And it's got a camera focused on this young baby who's in a high chair. Very young child has no idea what they're doing, you know. And the parents say, okay. So they hold out their hands and the baby grabs their hands. And then they lead a prayer. And the child essentially is mimicking the behavior of his parents. And at the end, everybody says, amen, he can, amen, whatever. And, oh, isn't that sweet? It's just adorable. It's so cute. He's praying to Jesus. I came from a culture that would have done cartwheels over this video. It's so beautiful. It's so sweet. He's being taught to give gratitude. Prayer is such a beautiful act as he's connecting with something larger than himself. I mean, it's hard on the surface to come out against this stuff, especially in religious cultures, because we are taught that this is beautiful. It's so wonderful. I commented on the WAFJ's thread, and I said this. Of course, for many, the first reaction to this clip is an emotional one. Oh, this is so cute. The correct reaction should be, this kid is being taught to parrot a religious ritual he does not and cannot fully understand. Just Google mirror neurons. It's fascinating. And his parents, seeking to replicate their own God belief in their offspring, are programming into an impressionable brain the motions representing belief and allegiance. Essentially, they are saying, here's what you think. If you still think it's cute, imagine he's praying to Allah or Satan. And then ask yourself how much of a right a parent has to pound a religious ideology or agenda into the mind of an impressionable child. A friend of mine likened it to writing a religious program onto a child's mental hard drive. Often, the child grows to adulthood never knowing anything else. He's unaware of other programs out there, and he's never been given an uninstall option. So he runs it for his entire life because, hey, it's the program. And he quite possibly does the same to his own children and to their children and their children. Instead of teaching him what to think, give him critical thinking skills so he knows how to think. And most importantly, realize this child deserves the right to grow into a skin that isn't a mere hand-me-down from mom and dad. Several people chimed in elsewhere on the thread with kind of a similar thing. Some people said it's brainwashing, it's programming, it's shameful. Someone said child abuse. And I tend to think in some ways, yeah, this is abusive. I mean, it's, you know, you're teaching a child to believe in magic, and you are teaching the child to believe it as fact. You may be inhibiting what the child can become. Yeah, okay, I buy that. One woman said, I'm not religious, but I don't see anything wrong with this. They're teaching their values to their child. I teach my values to my children, and my parents did the same. What does that mean exactly? It's not like telling them don't lie, but don't harm people. Look both ways before you cross the street. You know, don't eat something poisonous. I mean, that's teaching something practical to a child. But if you are teaching them to mimic a word of gratitude to an invisible other out there, you know what? Teach them to thank the cook, to live a life of gratitude for those who made the meal possible. But this is something else. Another woman said, maybe if we had more praying or any kind of structure in homes where parents teach good morals, all caps, then there would be less school shootings. Oh, that's nice. The reason people are shooting up schools is because we aren't teaching our young children how to pray in their high chairs. You got to be shitting me. Who cares what they are teaching? This is her words. Who cares what they are teaching? The point is they're doing it as a family. Just stop and think about the implication of that sentence. Who cares what they are teaching to the child? It's like a style over substance, celebration of ignorance. It's a beautiful act. Who cares what it means? They're beautiful words. Who cares if they're true? Another guy named John said, it's none of your business. Who put you in charge? I'm not in charge. I'm weighing in with an opinion on a publicly posted video. What is that quote that said, let me never make the mistake, I'm paraphrasing, let me never make the mistake of saying I'm persecuted when I'm merely being contradicted? This is essentially what this is. Who do you think you are? Who put you in charge? Another woman said, if you put nothing into a box, it will remain empty. Who said anything about putting nothing into this child's life? Right? I mean, I'm so surrounded by either straw man arguments or nonsensical arguments or these weird allegiances to faith and faith-based thinking, I become frustrated. I become angry. And I think this poor kid, who's all smiles, right? The kid is just cluelessly happy. Welcome to religion, is going to grow up and everybody's going to be celebrating this cluelessness. I remember this was years ago. I was in Denver. I think I was doing a convention there, and Natalie and I had taken a couple of extra days. And we were downtown. Forgive me if I've told this story before. 250 shows, it's hard to remember which anecdotes I've already given out. But we were downtown. We're hanging out and just enjoying the day. And they had this group on the corner of Hare Krishnas. And they're out there, and they're just like you see them on television. The bald heads and the robes and the music's playing and they're all kind of dancing and they wide-eyed bliss, kind of a blank face with these big wide eyes and blank smiles. It reminds me, if you've ever seen the movie, was it Airplane? Where the pilot is walking, trying to get to the jet bridge, and he's surrounded by all these people asking for donations, you know. Hey, we're from the Church of Jesus Christ of Lunar Consciousness. Would you like to make a donation? It was exactly like that, okay? And so everybody had their cell phones out. We're all taking video of this whatever, this performance, and they're handing out literature, obviously promoting whatever it is they're promoting. So Krishna consciousness or whatever. And I remember distinctly there was a young girl, 15-ish maybe, head shaved, in the robe, and she's just smiling ear to ear. And she's handing out her literature to everybody who makes a donation. Give them a buck or two or five, and then they would give you this little book of, I don't even know what it was, in return. And I don't know if this is how they pay their bills, or if it's just a merely evangelical enterprise, or it's a creative exercise. They want to go out and just express themselves publicly. I'm not sure what it was about, but they were there. And so many looked at this young girl and her wide eyes and her grand smile and the fact that she looked genuinely happy. She looked genuinely happy. And they saw beauty. They saw someone who had found a place in the world that made them genuinely happy. And they had a sense of purpose. They had a life calling or life mission. They felt joy in their heart and wanted to spread joy to other people. This was something beautiful to them. I'm sure of it. You should have seen their faces. And as I'm watching the same scenario, I'm, of course, the fly in the ointment. I'm the pain in the ass who looks at her and I think, this breaks my heart. Not because I didn't think she was genuinely happy, but because by the look of this culture that was on display, this very insular, almost cult-like, well, cult-like atmosphere, you immediately were struck with the reality that she was raised in a very small cocoon, almost certainly spoon-fed the Krishna teachings and doctrines and chants and mantras and prayers and whatever it is that they do. From her earliest memories, this was it. This was her normal. She was mimicking what she had been taught by her parents, by her elders, by her friends and associates, by the guardians, by the culture, by the tribe, whatever. And there is an extremely good chance that she had never genuinely been exposed to the rest of the world. She had an outside-in look at the rest of the world. She had to look at everything through the lens of Krishna. So in a way, her life was spoon-fed to her by someone else. She was never genuinely given the chance to go out and discover other people, other belief systems, other cultures, to discover science, to discover our world, to discover the cosmos, to sponge up all the knowledge she could get, and perhaps have a more fulfilling life, a better life, certainly a less ignorant life because of it. And to many people, the fact that she was in a spot and she was safe and she had a tribe and she was happy is enough. And when somebody like me says, this is tragic, this girl may never realize her full potential. There's a whole life she might have lived that she will never know because she was placed in this bubble way over here and cordoned off from the real world, or at least the rest of the world. She is mimicking the practices, the customs, the traditions, and beliefs of those who are around her and those who came before her, and she was likely never given a chance, not really, to find out what may have fit best for her. Now, the fact that she's happy, is that enough? Is that the trump card? You know, they're happy. And to some people, happiness is it. I mean, happiness is the end zone, especially if they believe we only have one life here. You know, as long as she's happy, she's in a good place, she's living a joyful life, who cares what she's happy about? I'm reminded of that George Bernard Shaw quote where he says, the fact that a believer is happier than a skeptic is no more to the point than the fact that a drunken man is happier than a sober one. And that's kind of where I fall. Happy is wonderful. Happiness is something we should pursue and attempt to create. Happiness rooted in the real world. But, you know, if you gave me the chance to stay inside the matrix or unplug, I think for me, I'd rather know. I'd rather unplug and see the reality and then start to build from that foundation. Christianity makes me happy. Yeah, that's nice. I'm a Hare Krishna, and I'm happy. I'm a Scientologist, and I'm happy. And this is quite often the argument that people throw at me time and again. Oh, it gives them so much joy. It gives them purpose. Yeah, so? And this is the argument so many people throw in my direction when I raise a finger of challenge, and probably you see much of the same when you do the same. You're not insulting them. You're saying, is this really the best way to go? And they say, but why would you try to interject negativity into a situation where people feel so much bliss and joy and happiness? You're disrupting these calm waters with your questions and with your challenges. It's like that commenter, you know, who cares what they're teaching? Happiness is all we really want. Happiness is all we really need. And you know, maybe they're right. Maybe that's all we really want is just to be happy. Do you think this kid in the high chair is going to grow up and just be internally happy? You think he's going to remain an island unto himself with a intensely personal belief that does not ripple outward to affect others? Or will that belief inform how he teaches his own children one day and how they teach their children? Will it inform how he acts and reacts to other people, how he votes? Will it inform how he participates in the real world, how he interprets what he is seeing and hearing and experiencing all around him? His religious belief, his belief in this invisible other, will inform almost everything he does, right? And that ripple goes outward and affects others, and it affects the world we live in. Whether it's true or not matters. Whether it's substantiated by the evidence or not matters. Aaron Roth's got this great quote I always like to throw out. It says, if it doesn't matter what the facts are, then it doesn't matter what the truth is. Well, does it matter what the truth is? There was a discussion brought to my attention from this, I guess he's a 16-year-old, and he posted this, essentially it's a request for rescue on Reddit. And we shared it on our social media pages, me and several other activists, Nathan Phelps and others. He said, I recently turned 16. My mom's a very devout Christian. I go to a Christian school and live in Texas. While I'm secretly agnostic, I still go to church with her, a small-sized Southern Baptist church, and go through the motions, even though I don't know the significance of anything there. However, I made a grave mistake recently by coming out to my close friend in school as being homosexual, and that I'm not attracted to females. He immediately went over to my mother without my knowledge that very day and told her every word of what I said. My mom then confronted me and demanded to know if it was true. We had a long argument before she finally realized her son was gay. She's very shrewd at detecting if someone is lying to her, and I'm a really bad liar. She then screamed at me to go to church with her at that instant and threatened to disown me. After consulting with our pastor, he told us straight up he was going to conduct a gay exorcism and remove the homosexual demons to cleanse my body in front of the whole church next week. Following that, I'll have to attend conversion therapy where I'll have to spend months there to pray the gay away, depending on my willingness to repent my sin. When I asked what they were going to do to me there, because I was terrified of the stories I've heard, such as electrocuting genitals and so on, I was ordered brusquely by my mother and father to shut up. My pastor then told me, they might be a little rough, but ultimately we love you and we all want you to be a respectable, upright, and God-fearing young man once again. My parents are in full support of the pastor's decisions, and I have no savings whatsoever to leave home on my own. I'm still studying in the Christian school they pay for, and I'm totally lost on what to do because I'm still a minor. Please, everyone, I'm in desperate need of help. Is there anything I can do to convince my parents or pastor and leave me alone? Several people have rallied to this guy's defense. Now, his parents are happy in their belief, or they think they're happy. They have purpose. They found their niche in the world. Does their son have a right to be his own person? Or is he consigned to simply be an echo, a parrot of what they think he should be or what he should do? Should he have his whole life sort of force-fed to him by these two people in what I consider to be an abusive situation? Imagine the kid in the high chair. If he grows up and he's in the standard Protestant Christian home in the Midwest or in the South, and he declares at the age of whatever that he's a non-heterosexual, it's not unthinkable that his own parents might do some kind of intervention or provide some kind of emotional or even financial consequence for not doing it their way. It's so frustrating to look around and just see the insanity all around us. There was an article just printed recently in the New York Times, dated November 2nd. It said, in religious arbitration, scripture is the rule of law. A few months before he took a toxic mix of drugs and died on a stranger's couch, Nicholas Ellison wrote a letter to his little sister. He asked for Jolly Ranchers, Starburst, and Silly Bands bracelets, some of the treats permitted at the substance abuse program he attended in Florida. Then, almost as an aside, Mr. Ellison wrote about how the Christian-run program that was supposed to cure his drug and alcohol problem had instead de-gayed him. Quote, God makes all things new, Mr. Ellison wrote in bright green ink. The weirdest thing is, how do I come out as straight after all this time? To his family and friends, Mr. Ellison's professed identity change was just one of many clues that something had gone wrong at the program Teen Challenge, where he had been sent by a judge as an alternative to jail. But when his family sued Teen Challenge in 2012, hoping to uncover what had happened, they quickly hit a wall. When he was admitted to the program at age 20, Mr. Ellison signed a contract that prevented him and his family from taking the Christian group to court. Instead, his claim had to be resolved through a mediation or arbitration process that would be bound not by state or federal law, but by the Bible. Quote, the Holy Scripture shall be the supreme authority, the rules of the proceedings state. The article continues, for generations, religious tribunals have been used in the United States to settle family disputes and spiritual debates. But through arbitration, religion is being used to sort out secular problems, like claims of financial fraud and wrongful death. Customers who buy bamboo floors from Higuera Hardwoods in Washington State must take any dispute before a Christian arbitrator, according to the company's website. Carolina Cabin Rentals, which rents high-end vacation properties in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, tells its customers that disputes may be resolved according to biblical principles. The same goes for contestants in a fishing tournament in Hawaii. Religious arbitration clauses, including the ones used by Teen Challenge, have often proved impervious to legal challenges. Scientology forbids its followers from associating with former members who've been declared, quote, suppressive persons, according to people who've left the church. But this year, a federal judge in Florida upheld a religious arbitration clause regarding Luis Garcia, a declared suppressive, to take his claim that the church had defrauded him of tens of thousands of dollars before a panel of Scientologists instead of going to court. Pamela Prescott battled for years to prove she had been unjustly fired from a private school in Louisiana. The crux of her case, which wound through arbitration, a federal appeals court, and state court, was references in her employment contract to verses from the Bible. In legal circles, those cases, along with the Ellison suit, are considered seminal examples of how judges have consistently upheld religious arbitrations over secular objections. They also reflect a battle in the United States over religious freedom, a series of skirmishes that include a Kentucky clerk's refusal to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, and a Muslim woman's being passed over for a job at Abercrombie & Fitch because she wore a headscarf. The article goes on and on. Don't tell me this stuff exists in a bubble. Don't tell me it doesn't matter. Don't tell me it doesn't ripple outward and affect other people. I guess the lesson here, beyond reinforce the wall of church-state separation is to read the fine print to find out who the arbitration is going to be handled by in almost any case, in almost any transaction, large or small. I had no idea that companies were putting this kind of arbitration fine print in their contracts. No clue. Conduct a transaction, someone does you wrong, you can pursue it legally. But according to this article, people can write into the agreement that it has to be handled according to their particular religious holy book, which, by the way, can be subjectively interpreted by whatever priest or pastor or counselor or religious leader or shaman or whatever they bring to the table. I'm so discouraged by the fact that it is so often the young and the innocent that pay the price for the collective insanity of humanity. There was an article in the Huffington Post recently about Operation Christmas Child. You heard of this? It's a big deal. It happens every Christmas as we head toward the holidays. America is supposedly one of the most charitable nations in the world, with over $200 billion given annually to charity. But many of those charities are religious charities. And the ultimate goal is not just to feed and clothe and aid people, but it is conversion. It is the salvation of the soul. It's like when Mother Teresa was doing the Missionaries of Charity work. And ultimately, she would just house these poor, disadvantaged, often suffering people in these warehouses with cots and beds and whatnot. It was just abysmal conditions. She was most interested in the soul. She wanted to give them a beautiful death so they could go meet Jesus. Well, most religious charities don't take that hard a line. They really do want to physically help people, but the end result, the ultimate goal that they want is salvation. They want conversion to their particular belief. Operation Christmas Child is one of those operations. It gives gifts to children who may not otherwise get gifts on Christmas. It is conducted in public schools and often endorsed by public school administrators. They often use student labor to compile these boxes of toys. Many have booklets added into them, which may include evangelical tracts, sermons, and even written prayers, and even a pledge card that the receiving children sign so they can become, quote, God's child. I'm paraphrasing from the article in the Huffington Post here. These boxes of toys are essentially bribes used to pressure poor children living in developing countries to convert to Christianity. And Operation Christmas Child isn't shy about their efforts, bragging about the thousands of kids they've converted. There was a church downtown back when I did church video work years ago. And they would take buses and they would drive around to all these impoverished homes in downtown. And they would pick up these kids and they'd bring them back for a Sunday morning service. And they had food and games and fun stuff for the kids. But in order for them to get the food and games and fun stuff, they had to listen to an evangelical sermon by a children's pastor. This was God's good work, right? Rescuing the next generation. These kids, quite often hungry, they had nothing, would jump at the chance to have a hot meal and something fun to play with. So sure, their parents say, great, when's the bus arrive? We'll have them on the front lawn. And they send their kids off to be scooped up by this church bus, dropped off in the church sanctuary or whatever. And they eat the food and they play with the toys and they make friends and then they plop them in chairs and they are essentially sold lies for up to an hour. They put them back on the bus and send them home because the end zone is indoctrination. Brainwashing. Teaching them what to think, selling them truth with a capital T, attempting to stamp upon them this brand of a particular church representing a particular denomination, inside a particular religion, representing a particular deity. I mean, is this real compassion? Is this how we frame compassion? Look, I know you're hungry and don't have the basic necessities of life. I have something for you. But hang on just a second. Listen to this. When I was in the church, we were taught that this was God's good work. It was compassionate to give them the message of Jesus. I'm not saying that everybody who does this or works for a religious church organization or charity or whatnot is some mustache twirling villain sitting back in the back, hungry to go out and infect everybody with the God virus. They didn't see it in that capacity. They saw it as trying to genuinely give people eternal help as well as temporary help on this earth. But still, at some level, don't you look at it and say, this is manipulation. This is deception. We are bribing these young children with stuff, and their parents are just fine with it. People sometimes ask me why I do what I do, and my answer is always the same. I speak out because I was one of those indoctrinated kids. I once asked my mother in a conversation, we were having one of our debates on religion, and those debates continue even today. We were having a phone conversation, and I asked a legitimate question. I said, Mom, do you feel like when you were raising us, and you had placed us in these small private Christian schools, and we were going to Christian churches and reading the Bible and whatnot, do you feel like that you properly exposed us to everything else out there in the world so that we could sort of decide for ourselves what made sense? Do you feel like you genuinely gave us the chance to understand every other point of view, at least everyone that we had access to, so that we could figure it out for ourselves? Do you think you gave your kids a shot? And with absolute sincerity and conviction and pride, she said, well, I didn't need to do that because we already had the answer. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. You taught me what to think, not how to think. You placed me in a reinforcement culture. Right? I'm in third grade at that time in a public school learning about Neanderthal man and those types of things, fossils and whatever else they'd brought in. I come back, I present what I've learned to my parents. They immediately freak out and place us in the bubble. And I spend the next how many years there, surrounded by no challenge whatsoever. Absolute deference to a single point of view. You know, as a young person, I shouldn't have been coddled. I should have been challenged. What do you believe and why do you believe it? Where did you get the information? Can you demonstrate that it's true? What did the experts in the field say about it? Has it been tested and retested? Are you willing to change your mind? Minute by minute, are you willing to reassess what you think? Say what you will about President Obama, but he totally scored when he said recently that college students should not be coddled. They should be challenged. Barack Obama, by the way, spent more than a decade teaching constitutional law at the University of Chicago. He was speaking to a town hall in Des Moines in mid-September and said this, and this is just a partial quote, but he said, I don't agree that when you become students at colleges, you have to be coddled and protected from different points of view. Anybody who comes to speak to you and you disagree with, you should have an argument with them, but you shouldn't silence them by saying you can't come because I'm too sensitive to hear what you have to say. Well, I buy that. Make me uncomfortable. It was when I was made uncomfortable in my own life that I became liberated from religious chains. I squirmed in my seat when I saw people challenge God and the Bible I assumed was true and this comfort mechanism which had been drilled into me. And I'm glad somebody made me uncomfortable. Happiness is not the only goal in our lives. Happiness is important. Happiness is something we should pursue. But blissful ignorance is nothing to be proud of, and it's certainly nothing we should train our children to participate in. The celebration of ignorance. You know what? I just leave it in God's hands. It doesn't make any difference to me. I'm just going to take it on faith. And everybody pats him on the head and said, that's so beautiful. Oh, it's a person of faith. Oh, we trained him right. We've done our jobs right as a mother and father. We're so proud. Like that Hare Krishna girl, I look and I think, you know, she's a person of faith, doesn't know anything about anything or anyone, but she's happy. And I look at her and I just think, what a wasted opportunity. Perhaps even a wasted life. And it grieves me. And I become discouraged when I raise a hand of challenge from time to time and I say, hang on just a second. Let these kids discover for themselves the world they live in. Give them the training and the tools, but don't make them clones of yourself. You have to be secure enough to have children who may not act or think like you do. The reason you had kids is what? You want to look at your child and see a mirror image of yourself? Is that the reason you had kids? Did you follow just the biblical command, you know, be fruitful and multiply, in the hopes that we might convert the planet simply by numbers? Let's just procreate our way to dominance. Or are you genuinely interested in creating a life that can go out and experience and do and say and discover things that you and I may never have discovered ourselves? Someone who might break new ground, who might challenge us and get us to squirm in our seats just a little bit. Now, I'm going to digress here for just a second because I want to bring to light a project that I thought was a nice tie-in to the conversation about the indoctrination of children, education versus indoctrination, teaching a kid how to think instead of what to think. Again, it's a project that's being undertaken by Dave Smalley over at Dogma Debate, who's come up a few times on the show today. In fact, he was the one who brought Caitlin to my attention, the young lady who's going to cap the broadcast today with her story about escaping the Mormon church. And anyway, Smalley tells me that they're working on this project, which is the production of children's books that are based in science and the work of some of our most famous scientists. And I thought the project had merit. I asked David Smalley to join me for a quick second to talk about it. Hey, David, how's it going, man?
I'm doing well. Thank you, sir.
You are working on a project which is sort of set to benefit parents of younger children specifically, but also the kids themselves. You want to tell me about that?
Yeah. So this is really exciting. You know, I was in Louisiana. I was doing a live broadcast of Dogma Debate, and I was in this guy's house named Mario, and he just, out of nowhere, he goes, "Hey man, I want to read you a story that I wrote for my daughters." He was reading them bedtime stories, and rather than read the books, he just wrote his own stories, and he starts reading it to me, and it's called Charlie and the Tortoise, and it's about this little kid named Charlie who goes to this island and starts noticing all these differences. And about halfway through the story, I realized he was talking about Charles Darwin. It's told from the perspective of a little boy named Charlie going on an adventure to the Galapagos Islands as if Charlie was a kid, and about how he meets this tortoise who's 200 years old, and the tortoise has seen these changes over time and how the finches start to look different even though they're still finches. And it's a super simple breakdown. The whole thing rhymes. And I thought, wow, that's an amazing story. And we put that aside. And he said, "You want to hear one about Carl Sagan? It's called Carl Goes to the Library. You want to hear one called Richie Doodles? It's about Richard Feynman and how he replaced drawings with math and made things simple." And we sat for hours, Seth, and we read 19 stories that he had written to his children. And I said, "Man, we've got to put these in front of people. Kids can get helped by this. Adults can learn from these books. This is magnificent." And so I picked my top favorite three, which was Charlie and the Tortoise, Carl Goes to the Library, and Richie Doodles. And we started a product called Tiny Thinkers. And it's going to be a Tiny Thinkers kids science book series for kids to learn about scientists from the perspective of little kids going on an adventure. And the very first one is called Charlie and the Tortoise, and the book is completely done. It's about 3 days from going off to the printers and should be in people's hands in probably within a month or maybe a month and a half. But yeah, we're actually fundraising for it right now because we're putting together the Richie Doodles book and Carl Goes to the Library, and we're a little short of the goal. So yeah, folks are interested. They can go to GoFundMe.com/tinythinkers. And we actually have a video there of us in studio talking about it. And then we actually show you the first book that's completed.
But now I can hear the cynics already, David. They're going, how's this different from people bringing kids to Sunday church and indoctrinating them with religious belief? You know, you're just bringing them to the church of, they're going to say the church of atheism, but even the church of science. You're saying that there's not an atheistic agenda. This is vetted information about science and scientists presented in a fun way to young kids.
That's exactly it. I mean, look, when you're indoctrinating a kid into a religious belief, you're telling them about a belief that you don't know to be true, but you have faith in. We don't have faith in Charles Darwin. We know exactly what Charles Darwin did and what he wrote down and what he said. It wasn't passed down over thousands of years and translated into multiple different languages, and that's not the case at all. We're teaching science. And look, these are fun stories. I don't think the word evolution appears even once in Charlie and the Tortoise. And then outside of that, with Carl in the library, it's about him going to the library to find information. It's about encouraging the search for information and about how he got interested in the stars and in flying and in airplanes and how he could go to the library yet take a trip in his mind. And it encouraged him and inspired him to learn more about the world around us. And then with Richie Doodles, which is Richard Feynman. By the way, Lawrence Krauss has tentatively signed on to write a foreword for that book. How cool is that going to be? Yeah. Richie Doodles is all about how, you know, he wanted to explain things, but the math was very hard. But he found a way to draw pictures in physics to explain math problems without showing the math. And if your kid's going to get excited about anything, it's drawing pictures instead of doing math. Right. It's a fun way to think about learning and exploring new ideas. So, yeah, this is very much about education and inspiring kids to go on adventure. As a matter of fact, the very last line of the books say, this character did this thing by going on an adventure. Can you think of an adventure you'd like to have?
The difference between spoon feeding them a worldview and giving them an excitement about learning and discovering and the tools to do so. And I think that has merit. The website is GoFundMe.com/TinyThinkers to help them meet their goal. And this is to cover the production of 3 books. David Smalley of Dogma Debate, thanks so much for sharing all of this with us. And we'll see if we can give you guys a little boost toward the finish line, okay?
That'd be awesome. Seth, thanks so much. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for letting me toss that in there as we talk about the indoctrination of children. It's just a project I thought had merit and might be worth a look. So you can go check it out if you'd like. Because I think these kids have rights. You know, they have a right to not grow up ignorant of the world, to not be intellectually hamstrung because their parents were locked in a religious cocoon. I submit that young children are not property. It's not I own it and I'll do what I want with it. Children have a right to be able to discover the world, the real world, and to define happiness on their own terms and not yours. Children have a right to be able to speak in their own voices and not have to simply echo your voice for the rest of their lives, especially if they're required to do so under the threat of emotional and financial blackmail. Children have a right to go out and push the envelope, perhaps far past where you thought the envelope ended in the first place. And to the parent who kills, who suffocates curiosity in a young child, in any child, you should be ashamed. Any God worth his salt, any God worth worshiping, would love questions anyway, would cultivate an atmosphere of curiosity, and wouldn't be threatened by doubt, and would be ready at a moment's notice, in a heartbeat, to be able to immediately solve the problem and answer the question and prove beyond any shadow of any doubt that this deity is real, and here's how, and here's why. And honestly, I think the fact that a parent wants to kill curiosity in their children betrays their own insecurity about their own belief system. The fact that they're terrified of questions, certainly contrary opinions, betrays their own insecurity about what they really think. If they really felt convicted, if they really felt strong in their position, if they really felt like what they had thought and embraced and believed and extolled was irrefutable beyond reproach, the solid rock on which I stand, if they really felt that way, they would welcome challenge. They would hold game shows and just say, bring it. Defeat us and we'll give you a prize. They'd sell tickets. We're having a debate tonight, 6:00. Hope everybody can come out. It's us versus them. We're defending our God, they're defending whatever. It's going to be great, and we're going to win because our God is true, with a capital T. They don't do that. Why do you think religious homeschools exist? You see that article posted just recently? It's in Rio Grande Valley, Texas. came out first in November. Texas case mulls if homeschool kids have to learn something. Parents are accused of not teaching their children because they were waiting to be raptured. What? From the article, Laura McIntyre began educating her 9 children more than a decade ago inside a vacant office at an El Paso motorcycle dealership she ran with her husband and other relatives. Now the family's embroiled in a legal battle the Texas Supreme Court hears next week that could have broad implications on the nation's booming homeschool ranks. The McIntyres are accused of failing to teach their children educational basics because they were waiting to be transported to heaven with the second coming of Jesus Christ. If you'll forgive the expression, Jesus Christ. Poor kids don't have a chance. They didn't choose to be born to dumbass parents who've decided to raise their children in an attitude and culture of absolute ignorance, because at any second, we're all going to Xanadu in the sky anyway. So when the rapture doesn't happen and these children become adults, they are completely unprepared for the world around them. Ugh. I read these stories and I hear these stories and I just shake my head. You ever feel that way? Now, I'm not naive enough to think that any parent could raise a child without biases. Well, we all have our biases. Maybe they're even good biases, right? But I do think it is important to be able to teach kids fundamental critical thinking skills and to foster an attitude of curiosity so that they can, as best as possible, determine their own life path. And they have our full support. So instead of us being judgmental and talking down to them and saying, be like me or else, we say, you need to be who you are, whoever that is. And there's a liberation, I think, that comes with that. It's a big difference between indoctrinating a child with a religious ideology and essentially saying, here are facts, and here are the tools for critical thinking and problem solving and experimentation, and here's how you test and retest. Here's how we go out and see whether or not it is true or not. And we encourage you to test these tools against other tools. There's a difference between indoctrinating and educating a child, and I think it is possible to draw the line between the two. And we shouldn't ever surrender to religious people who are claiming that we're simply practicing the religion of science or indoctrinating children with critical thinking, if that's even a thing. You've indoctrinated your child by making them curious. I just don't get that. Ultimately, the goal is to create thinkers. Faith is not the mechanism by how we govern ourselves. We want to think about things. That's why I named the website The Thinking Atheist. The Thinking Atheist isn't a person. It's a prompt that we should all engage our minds and not be satisfied with the prompts to just take it on faith, just trust it, just go with it, just assume, just take my word for it. No, we want to think about these things. And this is something we should encourage in our kids. The last segment of the broadcast tonight is actually the personal story of someone who was the product of a Latter-day Saints home, a Mormon church culture, and came to a point of skepticism and doubt, and then the shit hit the fan. Her story was brought to light several weeks ago, and I had asked her at that time if she'd be interested in joining me down the way to tell her story on this show, and she's kind enough to do so. Her name is Caitlin. Caitlin, thanks so much for joining me. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for joining me on the radio. Let's tell everybody your story in a nutshell. Can you kind of take me back to the beginning?
Yeah. So I moved back in with my parents after attempting suicide. And so just kind of have to take a step back and not have to focus on, you know, paying rent and living expenses, just to kind of get things figured out mentally. And eventually my parents, even though, like, when I first moved in, they told me I wouldn't have to go to church or anything, they started making me go to church. And one night, after I worked really late, I was working 2 full-time jobs just so that I could save enough money to be able to move out. One night after working really late, my mom woke me up the next morning and told me I had to be at church in 30 minutes or I needed to pack my bags. So I got up and I went. And then when I came back, my mom told me that she was tired of the disrespect and that I had to be out in 2 weeks. And so, you know, started panicking a little bit.
Well, let me stop you for just a second, Caitlin. You said the words attempted suicide, and I'm sure everybody in the audience is now filled with concern for you. I mean, we want to just take a step back and make sure. Are you doing okay? Has that season of your life passed?
Yeah, actually. So it's interesting to me because I went home to live with my parents to help with my depression, but the thing that kind of helped me the most is moving back out. Like, even though it's a very strenuous circumstance, I feel better than I have in years. I haven't had thoughts of hurting myself or attempting suicide or anything like that. And I'm taking, you know, medication, seeing a therapist regularly. So it's been really good.
So were you religious around this time that you were battling depression? I mean, how did this divide between you and your parents happen?
I started having doubts about, I was LDS. I started having doubts about the LDS church when I was around 16, when I was in my junior year of high school. But, you know, leaving the religion you're raised in, the religion your parents are in, and your entire family and all of your friends, it's a hard thing to do. So I decided to kind of throw myself into it. I decided to give it one last shot and just completely, like, go to all my church activities, go to my seminary classes, read the entire Book of Mormon cover to cover, and that's what I did. And so that's what I did in my senior year. And then after that, they'll tell, like, if you go to the LDS church, they'll preach and preach about how the way that you know that the Book of Mormon is true is if you read it sincerely and then pray about it. And then you'll have this revelation that the Book of Mormon is true. And so when I, like, prayed about it and that didn't happen, and I kind of was feeling like I, like, had to convince myself of things that, like, I was kind of actually disappointed because, you know, you hear people talking about how they just felt amazing and they just knew without a doubt that the church was true and the Book of Mormon was true. And I didn't have that.
Did you think, I'm not doing it right, I don't have enough faith? Did you take that burden upon yourself at that time?
Well, yeah, you kind of do. I like to, when you're in that situation where you go to church and everyone's talking about how this happens to them and it doesn't happen for you, like, for me, it was a fake it till you make it kind of thing. Like, oh, maybe that's what, maybe, you know, I felt like something there. I was just trying to make out feelings to be something that they weren't. And so, like, for me, it's like me trying to convince myself that these things were happening and, you know, saying that they did in front of others because, you know, it happened to them, apparently. And so, but because I guess, like, part of me didn't want to face the realization that if it didn't happen to me, it probably didn't happen to any of them either.
Don't let me pry too deeply into your life. You tell me where that boundary is drawn, okay? But when I hear you say, she said I had 30 minutes or else, I obviously am a little curious. It seems a bit extreme. So you guys had had a long road together that led to this moment, right?
Yeah. Like, after I decided in senior year that I would start researching the other side of things outside of the LDS religion and decided I didn't want to be a part of the church anymore, I didn't tell them. I didn't tell them up until I was moving out. I was moving in with a friend until I was able to move out to Salt Lake City. And I didn't tell them. Like, I felt, the reason why I wanted to get out so fast is because I was so afraid. I was sick of living like I was this person that I didn't believe in. And I was so afraid to tell my parents that I didn't tell them until the night before I moved out. And so, you know, this was kind of sprung on them completely.
So you had told your parents you were having doubts. You moved out for a short period of time. You moved back in. How long were you gone or not living at home with your parents?
So I had moved out for about 8 months before I moved back in with them.
So you came back. They are well aware at this point that you have left the church, that you've got doubts about the Mormon faith. They're obviously very unhappy about this. And so their solution was to say, get in church or else, kind of a tough love thing?
So when I first moved back in, we had this agreement, and it was that they wouldn't make me go to church. And then they also had this list of things that I had to comply by if I wanted to live there. And so it was things like, don't talk negatively about the Mormon church. Don't say anything bad about it. Don't, just don't say anything. And so, you know, sometimes, like, I needed an outlet. You can't just, like, cover that up and hope nothing happens. Like, I was really afraid of having all my anger. Because, you know, after leaving the church, you kind of get angry. It's like there's this grief process.
Yeah.
where you kind of have this like anger because, you know, this is something that I believed my entire life. And now I come to find out through research all this history that I was never taught, all of these things that were kept from me, just stuff like that. And so it's kind of like, it's a grieving process because of all the things that have happened. And so, you know, I didn't want to keep that all bottled up. So I had on my Twitter account, I had been blocked. I had my sisters blocked. I didn't want them to see anything. I didn't want to say anything that would offend them and hurt their feelings. And so I just thought, you know what, I needed an outlet and this is the way that they won't be able to see it. But someone, I'm pretty sure it was a family member of mine, was telling them everything I was saying. And so at that point, my mom told me that I didn't know the members of the church, obviously, and I needed to go to church to see that they were good people, which is kind of was a crazy notion to me because I was raised in that church. I was raised with those people, and I know that they're good people, and my qualms are not against the people at all. It was the religion.
So they gave you an ultimatum? They said, you're either with us or against us, that kind of thing?
Yeah, basically. I mean, they kind of saw my anger at the church as anger at them. They took it very, very, very personally. And so even though, like, I respected them, I did not feel angry towards them. Like, I understand that you're raised in something. They think it's right, and they teach their kids. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. But my anger wasn't at them, and they took it very, very personally.
So from what I understand, they essentially kicked you out with no notice, and you were scrambling to sort of find your footing, correct?
Yeah, it's interesting because actually just a few weeks after I had moved in, you know, they had this list of rules and it was like, you have to ask to borrow the car, you have to get a job, just stuff like that. And they said if I ever broke one of those rules, it would signify to them that I was ready to move out. And so one day I asked to borrow the car as per the rule to go to the lake with my brothers and a friend of mine. And after I was done at the lake, I dropped my brothers off at the house and I went out and hung out with my friend. And so when I got home, my parents, since I didn't ask to borrow the car for the second activity, they had all of my stuff packed up in boxes next to the door. And they basically told me, this is your life. You have nothing. You need us. So don't break our rules. Basically, like, this is the last chance. And so they knew full well, like, I didn't have a car. I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't have anywhere to get there. All I had was what was in those boxes, and I needed them. Basically, they were in complete control.
The last straw ended up being what? What finally got you kicked out?
The night, I worked really late. I probably didn't go to sleep till 5 in the morning. They woke me up at 8, told me to be there. So I probably got like 3 hours of sleep. I was exhausted, but I went up and I went to church. I took a separate car, of course, because they had already all left. And when I got there, my mom, she patted the seat next to her, but I was tired and angry because they made me get up and go to church after 3 hours of sleep. And I knew that if that was the same for any of my siblings, they would not have made them. But because I didn't want to go, they were going to make me and hold kicking me out over my head. And so I sat by my brother instead. And then in the middle of the service, they had a hymn where everyone stood up to sing. And, you know, in the beginning, my mom told me I didn't have to participate. I didn't have to pay attention. She just wanted me there. And so, of course, I didn't stand up when this song was sung. And I stuck out like a sore thumb. I mean, I was the only one sitting down, and we were in the front. And a lady behind me actually rubbed my shoulders and told me to stand up. And I said, no, thank you. You know, I wasn't rude about it, but I wasn't going to stand up. And so when we got home, my mom told me she was tired of the disrespect and that I needed to be out by the end of the month, which gave me about 2 weeks.
At this measure, though, you're already mentally packing your bags, right? You're already thinking, I'm going to have to find a way out. Is that correct?
Basically. Yeah.
And so you put together a GoFundMe page to help gather donations from anybody who would support you so that you would have money on top of your standard bills, just money to go and start fresh somewhere else.
Yeah, that's accurate.
And your parents found out about it, and then what happened?
So my parents saw it on Facebook because it was shared pretty widely. They saw it, and my dad, I'd actually gone to sleep early that night because I was used to working late, and I had that night off, and so I was exhausted. And so I'd gone to sleep early. About an hour after I'd fallen asleep, my dad came downstairs and woke me up and said, looks like you got enough on your GoFundMe. Be out by tomorrow. And I actually had to have him repeat what he said because I didn't quite process it the first time because I was, you know, still like half asleep. But, you know, he said, you know, be out by tomorrow. And that woke me up pretty pretty easily.
Your GoFundMe account then was shared by activists like myself, David Smalley, several other people sort of picked up this story. I think Hemant, the Friendly Atheist, was part of it as well. And you were seeking just a few $100s at the beginning, right? Just enough to get started. And all of a sudden, people really started to pitch in, yeah?
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, it was kind of like, it was a really scary situation. And so having that support from tons of people I don't even know, just so willing to help me, even if they couldn't donate, I got so many messages of support. And so that was really amazing for me to experience.
How are you doing today? I mean, are you in a safe spot? Are you in a place where you are supported and protected by the people that you're nearby?
Yeah. So I actually had a lady that let me rent out a room in her house until I was able to find an apartment. And so now I have my own apartment. I've got a full-time job as well as doing some things on the side. I've got transportation, you know, and so, you know, things are working out pretty well. I'm getting on my feet.
It just grieves me to think that family members will choose a church over a child or a religious belief over a child. I don't know if this is tough love or if they're embarrassed or there's something else going on, but, you know, it breaks my heart to think that they have essentially severed ties with you. Have you had any contact at all?
After David Smalley's posted the interview that he had with me and then also with my parents, I got a text from my mom saying, "We still love you." I didn't reply. I didn't know what to say, and I haven't heard from them since. So,
the theme of my broadcast is programming. We're talking about how church culture's indoctrination programs young minds. Essentially, the analogy I used was a hard drive. And they install that program. In your case, it was the Mormon program, right? The Latter-day Saints program. And they expected you to essentially run that program in your brain for the rest of your life. And you uninstalled and decided that it wasn't a good fit for you. And you decided to do something else. And you paid a significant price for that. And I wondered if you have any thoughts about the indoctrination of the young, what you would maybe witness behind those walls, maybe even in the walls of your own home. Did you have any sort of thoughts on how your life was impacted by these tactics?
You know, the theory of what you said, like a hard drive, it actually has a lot of psychological backing. Until the age of 8, we have very suggestible minds. It's kind of more towards evolution where, you know, back in days where our brains were still developing to be the way they are now, you know, you have to learn to be able to listen to your elders because there's some experiences that you can't learn from because you'll just die. And so we had to be very, until we got to an age where we could start to think for ourselves and fend for ourselves, we had to be suggestible. And so I actually have a mentor that he talks about that a lot because I'm going into psychology, and he says basically, you know, you have this programming, this basic programming that's enforcing you till the age of 8. And by then, it's just basically you're on autopilot. That's the program you run. And so sometimes we have to update the program. And so I think that has a lot of backing. But also, I see that a lot within the LDS church. I mean, in primary, they sing songs about how you can't wait till you're 8 so you can get baptized. When I was 8 years old, my parents asked me if I wanted to be baptized, and my response was yes, because that's what everyone does. That's what you're supposed to do. So I was actually kind of surprised that they were asking me because, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. You get baptized at the age of 8. That's what everyone does. And they sing a lot about, you know, can't wait to go on a mission, can't wait to, it's just, there is a lot of indoctrination with LDS churches specifically.
I'm excited, Caitlin, that you're taking control of your future. Are you doing what you want to do?
Yeah, I am.
Well, I appreciate you sharing your story. It's a very personal story. I know it can't always be easy to relate these types of things, but I wanted just to sort of share this one-on-one exchange with the radio audience so that they can get another glimpse into how the church targets young minds. I wanted to make sure you were doing all right, and I'm glad to hear that it looks like you have a bright future in front of you. That's really good news, Caitlin. Thanks for being a part of the broadcast, and thanks for talking with us. Greatly appreciated.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the broadcast tonight, and thanks for listening to this humble host rant just a little bit more on a subject that is very near and dear to my heart. Again, I think we have Reasons to be encouraged. Stories like Caitlin's and so many others where people are being set free from all the insanity. We'll try to keep that in mind as we keep on keeping on. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you next time on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast. Take care.
Follow the Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on the Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.